David Pierce is in custody for the alleged murder of Christy Giles and Hilda Marcella Cabrales Arzola. He's also been charged with 7 counts of sexual assault and 2 counts of transportation, selling narcotics related to fentanyl he allegedly gave Christy and Hilda when he offered them cocaine. Brant Osborne is out of jail, but is still charged with 2 counts of being an accessory after the fact. What we know about David Pierce so far is he is a self-proclaimed Hollywood producer. His IMDb page lists the teen sitcom Dawson's Creek and a role in the spinoff Young Americans. His bio claims he directed his first documentary with comedy legend Jay Leno, with a few other producing credits for various films. Christy's husband, Jan, said he and Christy's family have received a number of messages from other females who have eerily similar stories. Jan said the only difference between them and Christy and Hilda is they survived. Let's bring back Danielle Radin, an LA-based journalist for CBS Los Angeles. Danielle, what else can you tell us about David Pierce?
Women said that he posed as a big-time producer for Paramount Pictures, but that wasn't true. There have been some pretty shocking internet rumors about Dave Pierce circulating since 2009. So let's just go through these chronologically. There's an article on TMZ from 2009 that shows Pierce sued a prominent fashion designer named Lloyd Klein for allegedly throwing a vase at him and throwing him down a staircase. But Klein said at the time that Pierce allegedly broke into his garage, got a ladder, climbed into Klein's bedroom, and was screaming at him. TheDirty.com is a website that was very popular in the mid-2000s. As an anonymous gossip website where anyone could upload dirt on public figures through posts, pictures, videos, and others could anonymously comment as well. There was an article that came out on The Dirty in January 2012 titled, "Dave Pierce is a Bad Person." This anonymous poster said he got a girl drunk and took advantage of her. The poster also alleges that he drugged girls and concluded the post with, quote, "I think every girl should watch out for him." There was also an incident in 2018 where Pierce was arrested for suspicion of making a false report of an emergency, also known as swatting. During the incident, a Beverly Hills police SWAT team was sent to an upscale hotel in response to a bogus call. The Daily Mail released an article in 2021 saying an actor from Scarface, Stephen Bauer, witnessed a violent event with Pierce in 2008. He claims Pierce raped a woman at a party and she emerged from a locked room crying and trying to leave. The former bassist of the band The Scorpions, Ralph Reicherman, also told the Daily Mail Pierce kept a stack of women's IDs in his apartment, which he handed out to young girls. On a website called Every Caller, a person with the username Scarred by Dave wrote in 2022 that he would pick up drunk women in nightclubs, get them back to his house, steal their wallet and credit cards. The person called him the definition of a sociopath. Another user said they filed a police report over a year ago for stalking and harassment, claiming Pierce drugged her at his home in 2019. Another user on the site called Rot in Hell Dave said he drugged and raped her when she was 19 years old. This same website has posts about him as far back as 2012, saying he's a scam artist and a drug dealer.
Why hasn't Pierce ever been charged for the other alleged sexual assaults?
In 2014, he was arrested on suspicion of sexual assault, but prosecutors with the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office declined to bring charges. In 2020, another woman accused Pierce of rape. A deputy district attorney in LA failed to bring charges, writing in an internal memo there wasn't enough evidence to support the woman's claim that she was raped while being passed out. The district attorney said he is being charged with crimes now that he committed between 2007 and 2020. Why wasn't Dave Pierce locked up then? The answer is because the criminal justice system failed. It failed these past victims. It failed Christy. It failed Hilda. The truth is, this man slipped through the cracks for years because law enforcement and the district attorney did not further investigate these claims. If he would have been locked up for these other charges, he never would have met the two women who lost their lives. These victims should have been protected, and they were not. And Christy and Hilda ultimately paid the price for it with their lives.
Let's bring back Trinka Parada, retired narcotics detective after 25 years with the LAPD, now president of the Project GHB board, and a renowned expert on drug-facilitated sexual assaults. Trinka, what are your thoughts on the DA not charging Pierce originally? And how common is it for sexual assaults not to be prosecuted?
Well, it's very difficult for anyone to report a sexual assault. It's a very personal assault. And even under the most ideal, clear-headed circumstances, it's very difficult to come forward and talk about these horrible things that happened. That's when you actually know what happened. And especially even add to that, that it's a high-profile person. It's a politician. It's a movie star. It's a producer. It's a big businessman. It's somebody, it's your boss, somebody that has authority over you. So any sexual assault is very difficult to report. Now you add to that the high-profile thing, and now you add to that the drug issue. How much alcohol did you consume? Why? How were you dressed? Why were you there? You know, all these questions. And I don't care why you were there and how much drugs you took. You know, I don't care as an investigator. I need to know. I need to put it together for the consent issue. But that becomes harder and harder to come forward when you have no recall. Okay, I was at a bar. I was sitting there by myself. I was having a drink. I got up and went to the bathroom and came back. And I don't remember finishing my drink. And I woke up at home in my own bed. I don't know how I got there, or I woke up in an alley. How do you report that? How do you walk into a... Who wants to be the person that walks into a police station and says, I think I was drugged and raped. I have no recall of anything, you know? And they don't know who, they don't know how many, they don't know where. Terrifying. So a whole lot of these cases never get reported. And when they do, when your friends tell you, oh my God, something happened, you went to the bathroom and came back and suddenly you were acting really weird and you ran out the door with this guy that just showed up and started talking to you and you walked out the door with him and we didn't know where you went. You got to report it. You were raped. And the police go, and so what do you want us to do about it? It's scary how difficult it is to be the victim and come forward. And then when you are faced with a lack of training, with a lack of interest in the case, with a lack of follow through, it's really disappointing how easily these cases are put off.
Pierce has continued to plead not guilty and told the police at the time, at the end of the day, I didn't do anything wrong. That he had watched people partaking in things that I had nothing to do with, and I just tried to make the situation right.
Brant Osborne was charged with two counts of accessory to murder after the fact. Osborne, an actor from Beverly Hills, was arrested while working as an extra on the set of CBS NCIS Los Angeles.
Danielle, what else is notable about Brant Osborne and his alleged involvement in this case?
Police said it was Brant Osborne's car, a Prius, that everyone got into when they left the warehouse party. He's the roommate of David Pierce. At 5:11 in the morning, Osborne's car is seen in surveillance video pulling up to the apartment on Olympic Boulevard. A police affidavit described at 4:19 in the afternoon, 11 hours after they arrived at the apartment, Pierce and Osborne are caught on camera, allegedly carrying Christy down the back stairs. They get into the same Prius and drive to Southern California Medical Center. Pierce and Osborne then return in the frame of the surveillance cameras to get Hilda and carry her into the Prius.
What could be even more damaging for Osborne are statements he allegedly made after the deaths of Christy and Hilda. On top of dropping the girls off at different hospitals and trying to conceal their identity, Osborne allegedly told a coworker if cops had found the drugs hidden underneath the cash inside the car, they would have been in big trouble. Here's actor David Marietta speaking to CBS Los Angeles about his conversation with Osborne on the set of NCIS a few days after the night out.
He said, "I had the craziest weekend of my life," and proceeds to just tell me hour by hour detailed account and timeline of exactly what happened from late Friday afternoon to about Saturday afternoon, where he begins to kind of boast and create an alibi in the process of how he went to sleep. He woke up. One of the girls didn't have a pulse.
Marietta also told the New York Post that Osborne told him how they've partied, two girls came back to their place, and the girls had a bunch of drugs. Marietta said Osborne left the apartment to get a COVID-19 test for the commercial shoot, and when he returned, his roommate informed him that Giles was dead. Osborne said he checked her pulse, freaked out, decided not to call 911, and they decided what to do with the body. When they returned from dropping off Christy in Culver City, Marietta said Osborne told him they checked the second girl's pulse and it was very faint, so they decided to drop her off at a second hospital so they didn't get caught. Marietta also said Osborne's biggest concern after all of this was one of the girls had peed in the bed during the night. Let's bring back Josh Ritter, criminal defense attorney and former LA County prosecutor, host of Courtroom Confidential on YouTube. Josh, how would the prosecutors make the determination that Pierce should be charged with murder rather than manslaughter?
The difference between manslaughter and murder isn't really so much an idea of whether or not you have more evidence. It's really if you have evidence of intent. That is the big distinction between manslaughter and murder, is you're trying to understand with what kind of intent, criminal intent, was this person acting. So in a manslaughter case, you might feel that you have little proof that this person knew or should have known the dangerousness of their actions. There didn't appear to be any premeditation. It did not appear to be based upon any kind of malice that they were acting. So, you know, you see that in instances where it could look like an accident, but somebody was behaving with such gross disregard for the safety of others that they feel it's criminal enough to charge them with manslaughter. When you get to murder, now you're talking about malice, and you're talking about somebody thinking about their actions and intending to cause someone harm. And when you get to first degree murder, now you're talking about premeditation and malice aforethought. So really the distinction there has to do with what did investigators and the DA's office learn about the mindset of this individual before bringing this charges. Or before bringing these charges. And I think beginning to have an understanding of this person's background and how many times he has come close to this kind of tragedy taking place, now you begin to understand why they feel that this drifts far closer towards murder than a simple manslaughter charge.
What kind of consequences could Osborne be facing in this case based on his involvement and statements he allegedly made afterwards?
Even though Mr. Osborne has not been charged with murder, he is facing extremely serious consequences nonetheless. And that's because his involvement, I think the investigators and DA's office know that he was aware of what had happened to these young women. He was in a position where he could have done the right thing and saved their lives, and he chose not to. And instead, he chose to assist David Pierce in covering it up. And A lot of this is coming through his own admission. When investigators arrived at the home, they spoke to both Osborne and Pierce, and both of them gave incriminating statements, though they both felt that they were being a little clever in what they were willing to admit to police. But even Osborne, in his kind of self-serving comments, making it sound as though he was just trying to do the right thing, admitted that he knew that these women were in a very desperate state, that they were close to death, and he could have done something about it. Instead, chose not to, but chose to assist Pierce in bringing their bodies to separate hospitals in an attempt to disguise their involvement. And so the DA's office, I think, has widely realized that he may not have been culpable in causing their deaths, but was certainly culpable in covering it up and culpable in not doing the right thing where he could have possibly saved their lives.
Osborne was arraigned in July of 2022 and pleaded not guilty to both accessory charges, posting a $40,000 bond to be released on bail. If convicted, he could face up to 3 years, 8 months in prison. When asked about the rape and sexual assault charges against Pierce, Osborne told the New York Post that he had previously spoken to one of the victims the morning after one of the alleged incidents. It's not clear which incident or which of Pierce's charges he's referencing.
Osborne said he heard the woman scream in the middle of the night from the adjacent bedroom and asked if everything was okay the next morning. Osborne claims the woman told him we were role-playing, but wouldn't reveal any other details. He also claims Pierce never spoke about physically disrespecting women and that he had never witnessed Pierce disrespecting women, ever.
The third suspect arrested in this case was 49-year-old Michael Ansbach. Ansbach's lawyer, also speaking to the New York Post, said his client is nothing more than a material witness and that Ansbach wants to be an asset. He added that Osborne was the only one who accompanied Pierce to the hospital and that Ansbach wasn't in the Prius or any other vehicle implicated by police in the murders. Back to Danielle Radin. What do we know about Michael Ansbach?
Michael Ansbach, according to IMDb, is a cinematographer. He did camera work more than a decade ago for shows like Shark Tank and Dancing with the Stars. He was reportedly at the house that night. Police said that he's captured on surveillance video, leaving the place and carrying some sort of bag with unknown items.
Ansbach's attorney also told the Post that Ansbach had been hired by Pierce to film a documentary about electronic dance music. In December of 2022, while Pierce and Osborne awaited a hearing to determine whether or not there was sufficient evidence to make them stand trial, a grand jury indicted them. Both men pleaded not guilty. Josh, how could someone be indicted by the grand jury and they're still waiting to determine if there's sufficient evidence to make them stand trial?
In some rare circumstances, the district attorney's office will use the mechanism of a grand jury rather than going through a preliminary hearing. At a preliminary hearing, it's open to the public. The defense is present. They are allowed to cross-examine witnesses. At a grand jury, the proceedings are secret. The defense is not present. And so there's certain advantages to having a grand jury. In cases similar to the one that we're discussing, involving allegations of sexual assault, where you're going to have victims testifying to things that are very private and traumatic in their life, sometimes the district attorney will decide to use that so that they don't subject that person to further cross-examination when it's not necessary. And in those instances, the grand jury will take place without anyone's knowledge, and they will file what's called a superseding indictment, as they did in this case.
The indictment was unsealed the following January with disturbing details about the night Christy and Hilda died, Pierce's alleged history of similar crimes, and damaging statements from both Pierce and Osborne about their actions that night. Seven women were called as witnesses before the grand jury under the name Jane Doe 1 through 7. The victims gave harrowing accounts of their interaction with Pierce going back to 2007. One victim said she posted an ad on Craigslist looking for a place to live in LA. She received a text from a producer in Hollywood named Billy and eventually went to the apartment. According to her, Pierce was there with a blonde woman. The victim said Pierce told her he was a producer and a big Hollywood hotshot, bragging about being friends with Harvey Weinstein and Ron Jeremy, and that he had a lot of connections in Hollywood. Pierce allegedly offered the victim a drink, which tasted odd and salty. She said she was feeling funny, like she was about to pass out, and began slurring her words. The next thing she remembers is lying on her back with no underwear on and with the blonde woman between her legs. She said Pierce was behind the woman, forcing her to go down on the victim. Pierce then allegedly penetrated her with a wine bottle. When the victim tried to fight back, she said Pierce jumped on her and threw her off the bed, then punched her in the face. The victim said she ran out of the room and collected her things. Pierce grabbed her arm and knocked her phone out of her hand, shattering it, according to her. The victim managed to get out of the apartment and crawl to her car. Another Jane Doe testified that she met Pierce on Tinder. He was using the name Billy. She says she went to Pierce's house and had consensual sex with him. Then Pierce made her two drinks and took her to the club. She remembers doing cocaine with Pierce at an after party, but woke up at 1 p.m. the next day feeling dissociated. Pierce told the victim that they did cocaine and mushrooms and had sex, according to the victim. The victim went to the hospital for a sexual assault exam and spoke with LAPD. The woman said Pierce began texting her aggressively, telling her that they had slashed her tires and had her car towed. She retrieved the car with the tires intact, but had to get the LAPD to go to Pierce's apartment to retrieve her belongings, according to her. Back to Danielle. Danielle, what did the other victims have to say about David Pierce and the other types of acts he allegedly committed?
There were seven women called as witnesses before the grand jury. In sworn testimony, one woman said she met Pierce in October 2020 at a Halloween party. She said Pierce pulled her into a closet and sexually assaulted her. She said he then took her to his apartment on Olympic Boulevard and raped her. She tried to fight him off and was screaming. She blacked out and woke up with bruises on her wrists where he was holding her down. The witness also got into the specifics of the threats Pierce would make with so many women who experienced these assaults. Pierce claimed he did a background check on her and threatened her by saying her parents' name and address. He told her she would never get her real estate license that she was working towards if she went to the police because he's too well connected. He then made her apologize to his roommate for screaming all night. Another woman said that she met Pierce on a dating app in 2020. She said she went to his house and he poured her a whiskey drink. She allegedly blacked out and comes to discover Pierce sexually assaulting her while she was screaming no. Another woman testified that she met Pierce in February 2019 on an app. He claimed he was the CEO of Paramount Entertainment in his profile. She said he gave her a flask with a, quote, special drink in it. They went to a Hollywood club and stayed there until 3 a.m. He then took her to his apartment. Around 8 a.m, they had stayed up all night and he took her to his bed. She was insistent that she didn't want to have sex with him. He then raped her as she was crying and shaking from being scared.
In 2019, a woman said she went to a party at Pierce's house. He poured her a drink and she blacked out. When she woke up, Pierce was allegedly sexually assaulting her. She had to fight him off and got bruising on her arm from him as she fled the house. One woman said in 2007, Pierce sexually assaulted her as she cried and then harassed her for weeks after.
CBS 48 Hours also spoke to a woman named Erica Bergman, who talked about being traumatized by Pierce. She said she tried to warn other women about him on a blog called The Dirty back in 2013. She said Pierce would talk about celebrities that he knew and introduce himself as a producer for Paramount Pictures. The woman told CBS she believes Pierce drugged her one night. She said she slept until 4 p.m. the next day and woke up feeling strange and groggy. She said Pierce was in the room laughing and giddy, talking about how he sexually assaulted her while she was passed out and sleeping. She also said Pierce slammed her head into a marble floor, but she was too scared to press charges. Let's take a minute to talk about this. No means no. No woman should have to go through what these women have gone through and what they allege that they have gone through. It's important for us to believe the victims. Five of the seven victims remember taking drinks Pierce made, and then they say that they're feeling instantly sick or blacking out. Four of them said that he harassed them afterwards, even threatened one woman's family. Pierce telling women that he could help them out in the industry or threatened to prevent one from getting a real estate license. Allegedly humiliating them with insults and making one woman making apology tape for screaming all night. Back to Josh Ritter, criminal defense attorney. Josh, what are your thoughts after hearing the stories of some of the Jane Does and the pattern of accusations against Pierce?
It is really scary to think about that a man like this could operate for as long as he did without being prosecuted, without sitting in prison for the rest of his life like he probably should have been many, many years ago, many years before he ever met Christy and Hilda. But I think it's also important to understand that he is not an outlier, that there are men who operate like this and are able to avoid capture because of how difficult it is to bring these types of cases, that it is difficult to convince women who have been assaulted and victimized in this kind of way to re-traumatize themselves and to come into court and to cooperate. And it is difficult to put these cases together when it might just be the word of a victim against his word. And so many times it will end up being that it is a person who has done this more than once before they actually begin to face the music in court. And there are laws in California that will make this evidence in court incredibly powerful. There's an evidence code called 1108, which allows for not only the charging of other prior acts of sexual assault, but to use those to demonstrate that this person not only had a pattern, but a propensity towards sexual violence. In other words, if jurors believe that David Pierce committed one or two of these prior charged sexual offenses, they can use that to believe that he is the type of person to commit these types of acts, that he has the propensity to commit these types of acts. And if there ever was a question in their heads of what he intended to do that evening, that this evidence can be used to convince him that that is exactly what he intended to do that evening, based upon his pattern and propensity of drugging women and violently and forcibly assaulting them, that that is exactly what he intended to do with Christy and Hilda on this evening.
The grand jury documents also reveal more details about the evidence against Pierce and Osborne, particularly in the deaths of Christy and Hilda. The prosecution called 26 witnesses, with the most notable being Michael Ansbach, who testified about what happened the night of November 12, 2021. Ansbach testified that he showed up to the warehouse with Pierce and a few others in Osborne's high-end day. Ansbach testified that he remembers going into the back room with Pierce, Christy, and Hilda, and they all did Pierce's cocaine, which did not give him any ill effects at the time. He also testified that Christy and Hilda had their own supply of ketamine. As the group went back to Pierce and Osborne's apartment, Ansbach said Pierce made drinks, Red Bull and vodka, for everyone. Ansbach said he had the drink many times, but this one tasted awful. Something was off. Ansbach remembers that he started to feel tired and sluggish and wanted to go home because he had to work the next day. According to Ansbach, Pierce wanted everyone to stay and insisted that Ansbach stay the night. Ansbach testified that there was a plate of cocaine, which he said Pierce offered to his Chihuahua puppy, and then eventually Pierce brought out more cocaine. Ansbach said Pierce claimed that this was the highest, greatest grade ever and gave some to both women. He did not see Pierce or Osborne do any of the cocaine. Ansbach tried the cocaine and remembered it's burning like hell. He said he accused Pierce of trying to poison him. Ansbach said he passed out and woke up violently throwing up with blurry vision. When he woke up in the morning, he said Osborne had just returned home from getting a COVID test just after 11 a.m. Ansbach said Pierce went into the room which Christy was in and noticed she wasn't breathing. He said they checked Christy's pulse and Pierce became frantic and incoherent. Ansbach testified that Pierce was worried about his prior convictions and said something that still haunts Ansbach to this day. While they were discussing what to do with Christy, Ansbach testified that Pierce said, "Dead girls can't talk." Ansbach said he suggested calling 911, but Pierce was against it. He was against an ambulance coming and insisted on taking the girls to the hospital. Ansbach said he fell back asleep and then later called his girlfriend, who told him to get a friend to pick him up. Surveillance footage shows him leaving the apartment at 5:15 p.m. The next day, Ansbach said he messaged with Pierce and Osborne on Telegram. He also revealed that Pierce had two burner phones, with one of the numbers saved under the name Michael Strahan. Ansbach's testimony provided some crucial information about what happened in the apartment that night, particularly Pierce allegedly giving out new cocaine and once again mixing drinks for his guest. It's the same story we've heard over and over and over again from the Jane Doe testimonies. Ansbach also took a cell phone video in the apartment that night, which shows Christy lying back on the couch and Hilda up and alert, talking to Pierce about a song playing in the background. The video has a timestamp of 5:40 a.m. on November 13th, 10 minutes after Christy texts Hilda, "Let's go." The Uber arrived at 5:44 a.m. just 4 minutes later and left at 5:49 a.m.
So let's take a deeper dive into this. So we know that Christy and Hilda were still alert and don't appear to be in any physical danger around 5:40 a.m. But what happened after that? Between 5:40 a.m. and 11 a.m. the next morning? And why did it take so long to take these women to the hospital? If these women weren't breathing or having difficulties, why wasn't 911 called right away? Why were they dropped off at the hospital by masked men that concealed their license plate? Why not call 911 right away? Was there something being concealed? Why wait so long? Could things have been different if 911 was called? Would things have been different if they would have gotten to the hospital sooner? And what are we supposed to make of Pierce's alleged behavior in the aftermath? Pierce said he was trying to do the right thing. But what kind of person says something like, dead girls can't talk? Like Ansbach testified with an unconscious woman in their apartment.
Let's welcome back Christy's mother, Dusty. Dusty, I can't even imagine what you had to go through and continue to go through. I'm so sorry for your loss. As a mother, what goes through your mind when you hear something like that?
Well, first of all, it's heartbreaking. It is just as heartbreaking as, you know, Michael Ansbach saying that Osborne was complaining that one of the girls peed in his bed. I'm sorry that as their life was draining out of them, that they had bodily leakage is what happens when someone dies. And I believe the reason why they held Christy's body for 10 to 12 hours is because that's how long it takes GHB to get out of your system. But Christy was already dead. Her metabolism wasn't working. Her blood wasn't circulating. So it was still detectable. So them holding on to her for as long as they did, or for, and who knows what they did to her, because it seemed like David Pierce liked to have his women basically like mannequins in a death position. And we've been told that he does smut films and other type of films. I don't know if he did. I can only imagine what he did to my baby. And that she was a human, not a dog. I mean, you wouldn't do it to a dog. You know, that they had no care of human life. Brandon Osborne, it was like an everyday Saturday morning occurrence or something to them, you know? So to me, also that makes Brandon even more responsible, because he left with the knowledge that someone was dead or dying or they couldn't feel it. And all he had to do was call an ambulance. All they had to do was call an ambulance. And if they wanted to sell their story that the girls were partying, and you know, even though they were partying with them, and none of them overdosed, none of them had all this in their system, you know, all they had to call was, but instead, he came back and they searched on the internet how to get rid of a dead body / overdose body without getting in trouble. And they read it and did what they found on the internet. They claimed they didn't know her. They claimed that they found her in an alley and just saw her and were good Samaritans, and then threw her body, just like they threw her body over their shoulder when they carried her out like she was trash. That's how it makes me feel. She was a human being. She was my daughter. She was a person. And neither Brandon or David saw her as anything but an object that they could play with and that they were used to. And I think Osborne had more to do with it. He was his roommate. He knew what was going on. At any time, you know, he could call the police. He was free to leave the apartment, and he, on his own, freely came back. And that's just like Michael. Michael got out of the apartment, but Michael didn't call the cops. Michael didn't call the ambulance. And that also breaks my heart that he couldn't even pick up and say 911, and that there's a dead girl and another one that's not doing so good in an apartment that I just escaped from myself, and the police would have shown up instead of giving them 10 to 12 hours to take my daughter's body and, probably bathed her, washed her, bleached her, douched her, got rid of any, had plenty of time to try to get rid of any physical evidence on her using gloves. Same as Hilda. And that they just sat in that apartment waiting until the time limit for the GHB to be out of her system. And then they threw her away. But before that, she was, lying on, I don't know if Hilda and her were both lying together on the bed, on a bed, but the neighbor heard pounding all day. That was Hilda. That was not Christy. And if just one of the neighbors had called, they would have at least been able to save Hilda. I believe Christie's was a pretty quick overdose because he mixed the toxicity that he mixed, and the combination was a lethal shot like you do to somebody like the death penalty. And that Christie went quickly. That's what this mother prays, that she went quickly.
Dusty, we're so sorry for your loss and what you've been through. There aren't words that can describe how difficult the situation is for you, and we really appreciate you sharing this with the listeners. Our thoughts and prayers are with you and your family. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Let's bring back former District Attorney Josh Ritter. Josh, how significant will Ansbach's testimony be?
I don't think you can really understate how important Ansbach's testimony is going to be. I mean, there's no way around. He is going to be the star witness for the prosecution. And though this man's behavior, I don't think anyone would categorize as being heroic that evening. He certainly has an opportunity through his testimony at trial to really do the right thing here and bring justice, because what he does, more importantly than anything, is fills in all the gaps. He was an eyewitness to nearly everything that took place. And though this investigation was very thorough and they did an amazing job of trying to piece together the events of that evening, there are still gaps that Ansbach can provide to the jurors. He was with Pierce when they met the girls. He was with Pierce when he first started plying both Christy and Hilda with drugs and alcohol. He was with them when they were back at the house, and Pierce started mixing cocktails that Ansbach talks about during his grand jury testimony as tasting funny and something being off about it, and that it even had incredibly negative effects on him. And probably most crucial and damning to Pierce, and perhaps even the reason why this case is a murder case, was a statement made by Pierce that Ansbach will be able to testify to, where he said, "Dead girls can't talk." And what that tells us is what he intended. He realized he could benefit and save himself if these girls were actually dead. Because if they survived, they could tell authorities what had taken place, and he knew that would be the end of him. So that alone I think, pushes this case, if there was ever a doubt, from manslaughter into a murder. And without Ansbach's willingness to cooperate and testify, you wonder if this case would still be having troubles getting off of the ground.
Outside of Ansbach and the other victims, there is also witness testimony regarding Pierce and Osborne's actions that night and what they shared with friends the next day. David Marietta, the NCIS Los Angeles actor who spoke to Osborne on set that day, also testified to the grand jury. Marietta said that Osborne told him he just had the craziest and wildest weekend of his life. But the conversation took a turn when Osborne mentioned one of the girls wasn't breathing. Marietta said Osborne told him the girls took ketamine and began acting weird. He says he went to bed and the next day, one of his roommates told him one of the girls wasn't breathing. According to Marietta, Osborne checked her pulse but couldn't find one and said she was cold. Marietta said Osborne told him they were frantic and wanted to call 911 but didn't. He said they came up with a plan to roll the woman up in a carpet or blanket and take her to the hospital, removing the license plates from their car beforehand. Marietta also said Osborne told him they were considering telling the police that the girls just wandered into their property drunk or under the influence of drugs. When they returned home from the hospital, Osborne told Marietta they checked on Hilda and found a faint pulse, so they took her to a different hospital. Marietta said Osborne also told him about the police search and told him it's a good thing the back of the car wasn't searched because there was a bag of money, and under the bag of money, there was a bunch of drugs. He said Osborne also talked about having one of the girls' cell phones and how police could still track a phone even if it's turned off. He told Marietta they broke the phone and ditched it. Okay, so let's break this down. Here, Osborne and Marietta are on a TV set, and Osborne is bragging about the night out with the coworker the same day that Christy was found dead. And while Hilda was in the hospital fighting for her life, he admitted to not only planning to bring the girls to separate hospitals, but based on what Marietta said, knowingly removing the license plates from the car and coming up with an alibi if the police asked how the girls got there. Osborne also admitted to hiding drugs from the police and not only possessing but destroying one of the girls' cell phones to avoid being tracked, or in other words, destroying evidence. And here he's telling this story to Marietta. So we now know from the grand jury testimony that the phone was Hilda's. Let's welcome back Hilda Marcella's sister, Fernanda. Fernanda, what was your reaction to learning Pierce and Osborne allegedly kept and destroyed Hilda's cell phone?
I mean, I think for me, again, it's pretty obvious. Like, and then, like, why would they even do that if they have nothing to hide? So there are, like, so many things and so many facts that point to this. Beyond the drugs, like, as my mom already also said, like, at the hospital, they were also telling us, like, besides the drugs, is the fact that she was this long amount of time without breathing, without oxygen. So there are, like, so many facts beyond this drugging. Like, if they had just taken them to the hospital sooner, call 911, doing something to help, things might have turned differently. And instead, they just cover... they chose to cover their tracks. And yeah, I think that's the choice that cost my sister and Christy their lives.
The family will never know if things happened differently, if 911 was called right away, that their loved ones could be here today. So many unanswered questions. Josh, Brant Osborne is charged with two counts of being an accessory to murder. How did the prosecutors get to that point, knowing what Pierce is charged with and the evidence against him?
I think the way that the DA finally laid this case out in their heads and how they then eventually charged it is the far more culpable person and the person leading the charge and the person who was involved in supplying narcotics, dosed narcotics to these girls, and an obvious attempt to likely sexually assault them that then led to their death was Pierce. Osborne, I think, they didn't have as much evidence that he was, quote unquote, in on it. They may not have had evidence that Osborne knew what was in the drugs being supplied to Christy and Hilda. And therefore, proving his intent and willingness to participate in the assault will probably prove more difficult for prosecutors. But as far as evidence showing that he knew after the fact, after the assault, after their near death, and perhaps even the likely death of Christy still at the apartment, he didn't do the right thing. His decision at that point was to preserve himself and cooperate with Pierce in trying to cover this up and evade capture for the both of them. And so, realizing what they have as prosecutors, what they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt in court, they felt more comfortable in this theory. And I think it's the right thing because I think it will make both cases stronger against both of these gentlemen.
The prosecution also spoke to several forensic experts and criminalists who conducted Christy and Hilda's autopsies and toxicology exams. Dr. Terry Stockham, a forensic toxicologist, testified to explain the effects of drugs like GHB and how it caused victims to experience periods of blacking out or memory loss. Dr. Stockham corroborated the witness testimony from Pierce's alleged victims as being consistent with the effects of GHB. Christy's toxicology results revealed a significant amount of fentanyl in her system. Dr. Stockham said that it was consistent with an overdose concentration and fell within the range of typically observed fentanyl-related fatalities. Additional testing also confirmed the presence of GHB in Christy's system, which Dr. Stockham said was not a fatal level on its own, but an impairing amount that could cause significant cognitive and physical impairment. Hilda's toxicology results are less clear due to the amount of time that had passed before the testing was done. Hilda's initial drug screening found a presumptive positive for cocaine, fentanyl, methamphetamines, and MDMA. Marisol Rodriguez, the criminalist with the LA County Department of the Medical Examiner who conducted Hilda's toxicology test, testified that the blood serum used to test Hilda's blood against fentanyl was an insufficient amount, meaning they couldn't determine if certain drugs were present. Though it's worth noting, that doesn't mean that those drugs weren't present, just that they weren't detected. Let's welcome back Dr. Jay Vargas, toxicology expert and associate professor at California State University School of Criminal Justice and Criminalistics in LA. Dr. Vargas, how common is it in the post-mortem toxicology testing to have insufficient samples?
That is something that happens in medical examiner cases. If there's not enough sample, unfortunately, then it's on, the quantity is not sufficient to do all the testing. But I think we can probably assume that there's a similar drug profile likely for the two. And again, very likely that fentanyl was the biggest driver of that. Knowing that, all these gentlemen needed to do was to call 911, right? When you notice someone who is having a hard time breathing, you can look into their eyes, you can see that they're, and they may or may not have known this, right? But you can see their pupils are pinpoint pupils, labored, shallow breathing. You call 911. emergency responders would come. They have naloxone, which is an opioid antagonist called Narcan, trade name. And it's very likely that these two women could have survived this, right? But clearly they panicked. They didn't know what was going on. And they decided to do what they thought was best. Unfortunately, time is everything for these types of cases. Once you stop breathing, of course, obviously that's not going to work out well. And so we have the tragic outcomes for both of these women.
We do know that Christy had GHB in her system, consistent with the stories of the other victims who were all described taking a drink from Pierce, experiencing memory loss, and allegedly being sexually assaulted. Trinka, you deal with GHB cases a lot with your work on Project GHB. What do you make of the presence of GHB in Christy's toxicology report?
The problem with GHB is the testing issue. It is absolutely a critical issue in testing. This is one of the fastest drugs out of your system. It's gone from blood in 4 hours. It's gone from urine in 12. What percentage of sexual assault victims do we get that fast? It's not. So when you don't find it, it doesn't mean it wasn't there. I'm not saying that it was always there. You just missed it. But we don't have really accurate statistics, because if a victim wakes up hours later, goes home, tries to ponder what happened, is confused, and now she goes to the hospital and it's been more than 12 hours since she took the drink, you're not going to find GHB. That's why predators like it. That's when they can always say consensual sex and she can't, say otherwise because of the memory loss. So it's a very critical issue with GHB. So it's very complicated to do the testing. That's why it is so popular with sexual assault suspects. They probably know more than most cops about what drugs we test for and how long we stay in the system. This is why a lot of times you will see a sexual assault victim, like in cases like this, if the young ladies hadn't died, they would have probably kept them around, kept them entertained for hours to be sure that if they left, they wouldn't test positive for things like GHB. And they know how long these drugs stay. They know what they're doing. Unfortunately, many predators are quite educated on drug testing.
In our next episode, we reveal more from the grand jury indictment, including potentially damning DNA evidence. We'll look ahead to the upcoming criminal trial and what prosecutors will need to show in order to prove David Pierce is guilty of murder. Plus, we'll hear from the families of Christy and Hilda one more time as they prepare for the criminal trial. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, Girls Night Out.